Welcome to the Montefiore Einstein Health Technology Innovation Podcast Series. Today, we'll be playing a previous recording from an Innovation Biodesign Seminar.
And now I'd love to invite our speakers. I'd love to introduce Dr. Guha. So Dr. Chandan Guha is the founding director of the Einstein Institute for Oncophysics and professor of radiation oncology, urology, and pathology, vice chairman, and the director of translational research of the Department of Radiation Oncology at Montefiore Einstein. Dr. Guha is an internationally recognized radiation oncologist, has been awarded multiple grants from NIH, Department of Defense, and American Cancer Society. Dr. Guha has been one of the early investigators investigating the immunomodulation of radiation therapy. In the 1990s, this laboratory initiated collaboration with ImmuneX Corporation, investigating the immunomodulating function of two of their preclinical products, FLT3L and CD40L, in their quest of finding local treatment options that can convert primary tumor into an autologous in situ vaccine. They discovered that therapeutic ultrasound can be modulated to generate immune responses against tumor. His research is the basis for a clinical trial conducted in collaboration with Celldex Therapeutics. Dr. Guha, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. So let me share the screen. Okay, so what I decided I would do is just, you know, give a very brief introduction to what we are trying to do. The motivation has been that, you know, to have a comprehensive treatment plan, there are situations where you need a platform. And what I'm going to propose, instead of saying that I have a drug or a device, I'm trying to propose a special purpose vehicle that invest in and develop therapeutic solutions by combining drug, device, and cell therapies, okay? And essentially, I'm calling this as a convergence health incubator. Are you seeing the whole as a whole slide, or do I have to swap?
I see everything. Looks good.
Okay. So our main discovery for the oncology purpose is this dual frequency focal ultrasound machine, which in combination with radiation or chemotherapy essentially creates this in situ tumor vaccine. And so that's what we have been trying to develop. At the highest level, this is a unlike radiation, which can be only used maybe once or twice, but mostly once, ultrasound is non-ionizing, so you can really get to use that on a tumor multiple times. So we use an energy through ultrasound, which non-invasively is focused into the tumor, but normally devices are used either for diagnostic purpose or for ablative purpose. But here our goal is we don't want to kill the tumor, but just stress the tumor so that the tumor automatically goes for its defense mechanisms, which includes, you know, induction of heat shock protein response, which helps the tumor normally avoid the immune system and become chemoresistant and so forth. But we have found a very clever approach where we can use these tumors' defenses, but now turn it against them by highlighting those responses which are highly immunogenic. So essentially the goal is that we are doing focal therapy for systemic cure by inducing an immune response. So the ultrasound device which we have created, you know, can be essentially from the surface deliver ultrasound beams at a depth, and more or less, you know, the body thickness can be achieved, you know, without any problem. The only issues are for any ultrasound, air and bone are special situations where we have to, for example, in air, ultrasound will not function, but you can still treat something like a lung cancer by using an endoscopic ultrasound. On the other hand, in bone, the bone will heat up, and so one has to be prepared for dosimetry. the two components. While we do the treatment feedback, we also need a lot of treatment planning, and that those are the engineering elements which we are developing right now. And the goal is that while we, you know, have already finished a lot of work in the mouse, our next version is to make a larger device which can then be used for companion pets like dogs. So we have established a relationship with a veterinary hospital where we can do comparative oncology. And essentially that will allow first to do almost a trial in dog as a device development in collaboration with our veterinary collaborators, which will be a part to the success of the process. So I don't think we have the time, but I just wanted to share with you some of our thought processes, the motivation behind doing this, the strategy, the innovation and IP, and of course, leadership and structure, which the last two I'm not going to cover here. But essentially, the aspirations are, why do you need a special purpose vehicle? If you ask me, there are drug companies, there are device companies, and then there are radiation oncology departments who have a medical physics. And I'm taking a little bit extra credit for being a radiation oncologist, because you know, the original decision point to go into radiation or in medicine was someone who don't know how to do math and physics. Therefore, they end up in biology. But after doing that type of decision tree, when we ended up in radiation oncology, we say, oh my God, you have to pass medical physics as an exam to get certified as a radiation oncologist. So bottom line is that there are device companies, there are drug companies. Drug companies don't know what devices are like. Device companies don't know what drugs are like. And so we are missing out a big opportunity where a drug and a device can be together. And within drug and device, there are two other issues which we are facing. One is a drug is only valuable in cancer if by itself it can act against a cancer. And that is not holding true for us. For example, the FLAG3 ligand, which Sunit was talking about, has no effect as a drug alone. But in combination with radiation, it has, you know, very fantastic response for cancer patients. So therefore, drug alone may not work in some situations. Likewise, for device, you had a diagnostic device or an ablative device. And there is nothing called a device for vaccination. And so our uniqueness in the field is that if we can somehow pull this together, and yes, we may have to go upstream quite a bit because this is not normal to consider what are you developing? Are you selling a device or are you selling a drug? The answer is that we are selling drug and device together. And the way we are developing it, that instead of highlighting what our ultrasound parameters are, based on the mechanism of action of how the ultrasound is interacting with the drug, we can code these parameters as a trade secret or as a company secret, and code the drug with our device parameters together, so that when you are, let's say, giving a mitomycin C or you are giving a ipilimumab or some other drug, a certain form of, you know, ultrasound parameters will be activated as barcoded from the drug. So that's the reason why we did. So the opportunity is that we have several patents which we have filed within Einstein and Montefiore, which are in focusing cancer and regenerative medicine. The common element for both the cancer and regenerative medicine is for us to use energy, whether it's ultrasound-based energy or radiation-based energy. And so that's where I just wanted to show that, therefore, we have acquired a bunch of drug assets, definitely developing a device, and we are now going to use these proprietary assets of drug, device, cell-based therapy and diagnostic kits as a component for this convergence health incubator. I just want to leave at that and mainly use the other time for discussions. But you know, I have several slides. Anytime I can show you based on the questions you may have. So I just want to leave it at this and give the next speaker.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Guha, for your inspiring work, for your leadership, for taking the time, and for your support of our innovation program. That was an amazing presentation. Thank you. And I would now like to introduce Nathan Stevens. So Nathan Stevens is a co-founder at Instra Scientific, which focuses on providing streamlined scientific instruments typically used in the research and development of thin film solar cells, biosensors, and various nanoscale devices. These devices are currently in use at top research institutions and companies in the world, such as Harvard, MIT, Cambridge, and Dow Corning, to name a few. Nathan holds a PhD in nanotechnology and material science from the City University of New York, as well as certificates in data science and bio and health technology startups. Over the years, he has worked on various data science software and scientific research projects, ranging from building machine learning models to predict plant growth in greenhouses to novel RNA molecular probes featured in leading scientific journals. Nathan is also an adjunct professor in the Department of Chemistry at New York City College of Technology. Nathan, thank you so much for joining. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you. All right, first, let me say, I think this is the first time I've been in a room with, quote unquote, room with so many actual doctors. So it's quite interesting. The presentation today, I think, is going to be more along the lines of kind of telling the story of how Instra Scientific started. And
I'm so sorry, just a full screen. I think it's kind of hidden.
Okay.
With the speaker view. Great, perfect. Thank you so much.
Right. Everybody see that good?
Looks right. Good. Great, thank you.
All right, so it's just talking about the story, how this, Instra Scientific started. And it's not really a medical device per se, but it's really a research tool used in the making of medical devices. So it's a quite a different path than the previous speaker was with this actual medical device. And it has to do with just regulations and just, a lot of things are simplified on my end. So what do we do? We kind of define the market for, spin coater kits, and which is generally used, again, in the research and development of thin film-based solar cells, biosensors, and other various nanoscale devices. Biosensors is one of our biggest uses for these devices these days. And when we started this, we definitely didn't expect that. But today I would say that accounts for about 40% of the sales goes into folks who are actually developing biosensors. Key to these kits is that the average average commercial units of these things cost between $3,000 and $10,000. These kits typically sell for $600. And clearly this looks like something you could build yourself, and you could if you have the know-how in the background, but that's the point. I mean, our clientele are folks who are, clearly, don't want to spend $3,000 or $10,000, but really doesn't have the skill set to really build one of them themselves. So they look at our product. And for that $600 price point, and even at that price point, it's roughly half of what it would cost them to build one themselves if they had to outsource all the components and software development. So we save them money and we save them time. How this, what this device does is pretty simple. You put your sample on there, your substrate, you drop liquid, whatever you want to coat, and then you spin it, and that's it. So obviously, very simple device. Not too complicated. And that's why we're able to kind of replicate the functionality in a somewhat very streamlined device. So where do we sit when it comes to biosensors? What part of that chain do we see that? We see right away in the proof of concept of device. And our kits are valuable in that space because it lets you, number one, you order a device, within a week you get it. And you start building your proof of concept real quick. And number two, you're not spending $5,000 to try something and then it doesn't work. Now, the historical usage of spin coaters were all, you know, material science. So if you were, you know, in material science department, then you probably have one of these spin coaters available. But, you know, folks doing the biosensors are more from like the, you know, biotech you know, department. So they don't readily have access to these devices. And so our device makes a lot of sense to them. So we sit in right near the proof of concept, you know, do the biosensor. Again, biosensors are quite used in many different industries. And, you know, and you're going to see continued growth for that. Yeah, we, you know, this is when we started this, I assumed that, well, we'll probably sell 100 and then have to go do something else. You know, every year we keep getting increasing demands, and we have sold, you know, about at least over 1,000 of these units and 50 countries. And so it's been an interesting ride to see that. And again, when we started, my take on this was, oh, well, you know, these are going to be purchased by folks in small community colleges or undergraduate schools where, you know, there just isn't that much budget for to buy nice, you know, shiny equipment. But they still want to do some kind of research. It turns out that, you know, folks at all these top institutions actually end up buying this. And, you know, I've always been tempted to ask them, clearly you probably have a budget to get something better. Why this? And if this comes down to, you know, you just want to try some, you just want to do some quick proof of concept. And, you know, that's, our device is probably one of the best ways to accomplish that. Who are our customers? As I said, it's generally a lot of undergraduate students doing some small research program. You know, researchers again developing these you know, biosensors and other nanoscale devices. And well, ever so often we get from small R&D companies who you know, budgeted. You know, if you're running a small R&D company, you have to, you know, budget is an issue. So you don't want to spend money you don't have to spend. All right. So where did we get started? Initially, this company was started by me and a buddy of mine to do what's known these days as is laboratory information management system. So it's just basically a website that allows you to manage a lab. You know, I was thinking back then was essentially we're going to provide a website where you know, someone runs a small academic research lab could keep track of chemicals, meetings, publications and all that. So needless to say, that didn't pan out. And I think we're just way too early. This was back maybe, I don't know, 2006, 2007. And so, yeah, we were just way too early. And we kind of pushed this for a few years, you know, on and off. And, but, you know, because it, the good thing about any kind of software is that there, you know, they're relatively inexpensive to keep going. So, you know, for about, I don't know, $50 a year, you know, you keep the website going. And really, the only real cost in this, doing this, was just the sweat equity to, you know, keep developing the code and all that. And obviously, when we started to think about how we're going to market this, it turns out that marketing costs would far outweigh any kind of profit we would see doing this. So, you know, we kind of sat around and said, well, this is not going to work. Well, what else can we do? And, you know, that's one of the lessons, you're trying to do any kind of business. That's one of the main lessons you probably have to, you'll learn quickly that, you know, you have to pivot. You know, it's guaranteed you're going to have to pivot to something. You know, we had to do this. And, you know, how did we end up you know, pivoting to this kind of DIY spin coder or kits? It's because back in grad school, I built one of those things and I set up a website to kind of explain what it is, why I did it. And it just so turns out that if you did a search on Google back then, that was the first website that came up. So over the years, I was, you know, people keep asking, hey, do you have any plans for, you know, send me some plans to do this and whatnot. And I'm like, no, I don't have plans. I just built it. But it got me thinking, like, you know, is it possible for me to produce something like this that we could sell and make money on? I mean, you could always, obviously, if you want to throw enough startup money at it, you could always make it. And then you end up with something that looks like a commercial unit. But then you have the, you know, if you did that, you have the problem. How do you compete with the, you know, what's your competitive advantage now in that already crowded space? Because these devices are not new. You know, back in the 70s, they were developed. So the goal now was how do we get to a 1.0 product, or, you know, a bootstrap phase? And, you know, number one, it was just establishing the viability of, you know, building a cost-effective spin coder device. And that was critical. And it also kind of helped out with the advance of this modern electronics, in that most of the components I needed to build one was readily available in the, radio control, the RC market, like, you know, drone parts and all those things, that, you know, electronics. Because this device was just a motor that needs to spin around, drones have motors that need to spin around at a certain speed. So I kind of leverage a lot of these components to do that first, 1.0 version of that product. But once I was established, next thing I did was to move, you know, establish demand for this. And that also helped because folks were always emailing me about this device. But I didn't want to bite the bullet then and put actually, you know, a lot of money to do a production run. So I needed a way to establish demand, which was simply just pay somebody on at that point it was Elance Illustrator to do a 3D rendering of a device that didn't exist, put it out there, and just keep telling people, yes, this is coming. And we saw how many emails we got, inquiries we got for the device. And we decided, we definitely got more than a few, and we said, okay, we see some inquiries and we establish a certain price point and it would sell. Then next thing was just establishing the sales channels. And this is where availability of websites like eBay, PayPal, and now Amazon, it was critical to making this a success it is. Because prior to that, you have to list this in a catalog of Fisher, any device in Fisher, whatever, one of these catalogs, and maybe hope it see some sales. You'd also have to market it and pay money to market it and all that, which for us as a startup, that's like, I'm not going to do any of this. So I put it on eBay at that point. I remember back then eBay, only kind of scientific equipment you could get on eBay was generally used, probably didn't work well, many for parts. That's very different today in that most, you can get almost any piece of scientific equipment on eBay. Most of them brand new. And once we established these first 4 points, now, we went into doing a small production run. I believe it was like 100 parts to make 100 units. And I was like, okay, if we sell every one of these units within a year or two, we get our money back. So no big deal. We just have to, sell them and get money. It turns out we sold all them well within a year. And that takes us to the next iterations of the product, because one of the things that happened was that, we all had, me and my buddy, we all had day jobs at that point. So this wasn't something we could commit a lot of time to. And one of the issues with the 1.0 version was just, it just was taking me way too long to build, to assemble. I was doing too much of the work. So I kind of quit my day job. I said, all right, I'm going to take some time, really focus on streamlining these products, by improving the design, using some custom software and custom electronics, and lastly, some automation. And so that was what, after I left my day job, at the time I was at NYU, I was a software developer there. And so I focused on doing that. So for 6 months, got everything, did all this. And at the end, instead of, if you are going to build any kind of device for non-consumer device, you have to be very careful with any kind of custom software or electronics or to some extent some hardware, because it's quite costly to do these things at small scale. And small scale, I mean like less than 1,000 units. So the way we made this happen was that we just leverage components that are already on the market and just kind of program, just write the software for them, because software is relatively inexpensive to do hardware is quite costly. Like, for example, this controller device that's come from a company who made these this tester. And so I contacted them and I said, hey, this tester, I already use it for my application. Can you make some modifications in the next version to make it easier for me to reprogram it or repurpose it for my users? And then they were surprisingly quite happy. And as long as I ordered about 500, and that's been working out well so far. And exploring all additional products, obviously we saw the success of that first product. Wanted to add some more product line, but that phase just never really took off. So we just kind of from now just focus on this, getting that device and streamlining it even further. Now, where's operation today for this company? I would say, we sit in the middle of this and we mainly just do a little bit of fabrication, the assembly and the testing phase. And I'm trying to, we try to do most of our thing outsourced to external vendors. And, because my goal in this company is really to get to a point where I'm spending less, I only need to be answering a few emails per day, not even per day, per week. And it's generating revenue automatically in the background somewhere. So I'm not one to be interested actively running a company on a day-to-day basis. I have other projects that are much more interesting than this one, some data science projects. So I want to focus on those rather than, running this. So I'm hoping to get this to a point where, this is more or less fully automated and, we just cash in the checks and everything else just flows. Goes from there. Now, what strategic issues or lessons that I've learned doing this? Number one is obviously convincing researchers to take up this product, which fortunately I didn't have to do. I think the price point and the functionality kind of helps a lot with that. And one of the challenges is actually with convincing some folks not to buy this because. You're really looking for something that like a commercial unit that's going to do a lot more. And but even after I do that, almost 90% of the time, they still buy it anyway, because what's there to lose? It's $600, really, that's a cost of reagent. So if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So that's helpful to us. And the biggest challenge, I think, for right now, or anyone doing this kind of device, is just consistent suppliers and vendors for parts, because and you're not buying, I can't buy 10,000 pieces, components to make 10,000 of these units. It would just be wasteful financially, and I really wouldn't have any space to keep any of that. So it's, so buying bots of 200 to 500, and that brings us last about a year. But once that runs out, I have to hope the companies are still around to do this. So that's one of the challenges I'm facing now. In that the controller we use, the company disappeared, so you have to repurpose it. And again, customer acquisition costs, it's always a challenging thing to say whether or not we should actually go into marketing this, spending some money to market it. Because right now I haven't spent any money on ads or anything like that. Because if you search up for spin coders, Amazon or eBay have been very nice to just list that product on the first page. The team, again, that's critical. Right now, as you can see, I'm wearing all hats, and which is fine because, like I said, I'm most of the things right now is really automated or outsourced. And then, have a team of great scientific advisors, who, have to do any kind of testing or additions, and I reach out to these folks. And that has worked really well so far for me. So in summary, it's just that the spin coder kits, this allows you to cost the time and cost to get to these proof of concept biosensor devices. All right, so I'm gonna leave it there. Again, I just wanted to kind of hit the critical points of how we got started, how we end up where we are.
Great, thank you so much, Nathan. That was incredible. Congratulations on your awesome work.
All right, well, thank you.
And thanks for joining. Really appreciate it. And I'd now like to introduce Doug Eunice. So Dr. Eunice is an associate professor of orthopedic surgery at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He has extensive experience in the muscle-sparing anterior hip replacement technique, being the first to perform the procedure in New York City in 2006. He's also a pioneer in kinematically aligned total knee surgery, which provides a more natural feeling knee with improved function compared with traditional techniques. In 2016, Dr. Yunus founded Monogram Orthopedics to develop a platform that will deliver more accurate, less invasive, longer lasting, and lower complication joint replacement surgery. The platform includes 3D printed implants customized for each patient and a best-in-class surgical robot that sculpts a cavity in the bone to ensure maximum stability when the custom implant is inserted. Both the implant and surgical execution are based on preoperative 3D planning software. Dr. Yunus participates in clinical research related to hip and knee reconstruction, including anatomic knee alignment, 3D printing of implants, and robotics. He has received many awards for innovation and teaching. Dr. Yunus, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Sunit. You guys can hear me okay?
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, great. Here comes the screen. Let me know if you guys can see it. You guys seeing it okay?
Looks good. Thank you.
Great. So, Sunit said, so I kind of like Nathan, I have this dilemma where I have this annoying day job that I can't seem to get to quit. But it's, you know, it's a challenge to start a startup that kind of takes on a life of its own and starts taking up so much time to the point where it becomes your second full-time job. So I know that all the entrepreneurs on here can appreciate that, you know, fitting in working on your startup with your clinical duties is a challenge. And, you know, I find myself in between patients and in between surgeries. I mean, every free moment that I'm not being an orthopedic surgeon is spent working on my company. So, but it's a labor of love, and it's been a great ride. So, I'll just tell you. So we started in 2016, Monogram Orthopedics, to really take a look at how we could make joint replacement surgery better, less invasive, more accurate, safer, using a platform that encompassed a lot of different emerging technologies, such as 3D printing, AI, medical image modeling, and robotics. And so that's really what I'm going to talk to you guys about, is how we've combined these different technologies to create a platform that is really making a lot of progress toward delivering what we set out to do. So to first show you how we do joint replacements, this is one of my residents. And, you know, what you notice is that the implants that we use, they don't really fit. They're kind of off-the-shelf implants that don't really fit the bone. So we end up having to make the bone fit the implant rather than the other way around. And we just think that there's a better way to do this with customization and a robotic bone preparation. So let me show you kind of the problems with the way we do things now, which is kind of barbaric. You know, we use hammers and chisels and off-the-shelf implants that aren't really designed to fit any one patient. So here's a guy that I operated on, and he's doing really well after his hip replacement. He's cooking his marinara sauce, and he reaches over and feels something snap in his hip that we just operated on. And he's, next thing you know, on the ground, can't put any weight on it, and he's going to the hospital. And what happened is that he broke his femur because the implant just didn't fit quite right. And maybe the surgeon was hitting it in a little bit too hard with this hammer. But it's very imprecise and leads to things like these catastrophic injuries that require big surgery to fix. They're expensive, they're painful, and the revision surgery is really really high complication, and requires, again, a lot of pounding and imprecision and bone loss. So this guy got through his big fracture of his hip, and for some reason came back to me a couple years following and needed his knee done. So we did his knee, and it looked good. So 6 weeks out from surgery, knee x-ray looks great. The implant's well fixed in there, cemented, cemented typical knee replacement. And he comes in a year later and we start to see kind of these radiolucencies under the tibial implant. And yeah, we're nervous about it. He's not having any pain, but you know, it's a sign of potentially early loosening of the implant. Cause again, it just didn't fit quite right. And the cement was starting to degrade under the implant. And then again, like his hip, he starts having pain, really can't walk on the knee. And lo and behold, he comes into the emergency room with this catastrophically loose knee replacement that has just finally failed because he's playing tennis and he's active and the thing just wasn't good enough. It wasn't well fixed. The cement didn't hold. And he needed a big revision with all these stemmed implants and augments and things that we have to do to fix a really deformed loose implant. So these are real problems. This is a big study of thousands of patients where they looked at the burden of revision surgery, redo surgery for hips and knees. And what they found was that the annual burden of knee replacements is about 10% of all knees that are done. And the burden for revision hip surgery is almost 15%. So these are real problems that a lot of which can be fixed with kind of a better technique for doing the surgery and better fitting, more customized implants. And we look at what the reasons for the revisions are, mechanical loosening, dislocation, instability. These are all things that can be fixed with high precision, kind of personalized medicine. So these are the types of complications that we are targeting with our platform. And, you know, it makes sense when you look at this corner outside of my office in near Columbus Circle. This is obviously pre-COVID, but, you know, we come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And yet we're using implants that are of a very limited range of shapes and sizes. So we're not doing a good job of kind of giving everybody that the joint that they really need. And you look at, this is four different knee replacements from four different companies. And what you might notice, I know there's probably not any orthopedists on the call, but you can just look at this and say, well, they all kind of look the same. You know, they basically look the same. They don't look particularly humanoid. And, you know, they're all kind of these flat undersurface implants. And the reason for that is, again, we're limited by the inventory that these companies can carry because it's very expensive. And by the instruments that we use, you know, we use saws to make the cuts in the bone that accommodate these implants. So they have to all be kind of flat surface and look this way. Hips are pretty similar. You know, this is five different hip implants from five different companies. They all basically look the same and none of them look particularly human. They're not really designed to fit any one person. But again, we're limited by inventory and the instruments that we use. This is just a video to give you an idea of how we put a hip in. You know, this is how we really do it. You know, we take these big brooch looking things and hammer them into the bone to hollow the bone out to accommodate the implant. You can see it's just not high precision. I mean, it's really eyeballing and doing a lot of just kind of manual assessment of how well you're restoring the patient's anatomy. But we kind of imagine a world where rather than starting with a preoperative plan that's made with an X-ray, a two-dimensional imperfect X-ray, if we developed AI-driven algorithms that can take a three-dimensional imaging like a CAT scan and create a very high accuracy digital model, three-dimensional model of a patient's bone. And then if we had a robot that could take that map, that three-dimensional roadmap of the patient's bone and use it to very gently and very precisely mill out a cavity that would accommodate that implant to within an accuracy of a human hair. And, you know, there are robots on the market right now, but what we found, and I use one, there's a Mako, there's a robot called the Mako, which is really the leader in orthopedics. It's a very old robot that could never do this type of work. You know, Elon Musk would laugh at us if he saw the robots that we're using on humans, because they'd never use something like that in a Tesla factory. They'd use something like this, which is a really high precision industrial robot. So we actually went to the world of industrial robotics to a German company called KUKA, which makes a lot of robots that are used in manufacturing. And we bought their robot, which is very high precision and is capable of doing this type of accurate milling. And is, and unlike this industrial robot, is designed to work right alongside people. So it has sensors and technology embedded in it so that it's not going to be dangerous to have it in the operating room, but it's capable of doing all kinds of high-tech bone sculpting. So this is our actual robot in action. And what you can see is that we have developed the ability to track targets in real time. So this is tracking the bone in real time. It moves with the patient during surgery using infrared sensors. So as the patient moves, as it's milling, it can adjust to it. We've mounted cameras on the robot so the robot can actually see what's right in front of it. So it makes it very accurate because the field of view is very tight. We're not using cameras that are across the room. And we've added obstacle avoidance for safety. So we can actually tell the robot what the boundary is that we want it to cut into. And we can create, using various markers, a safe zone so that the robot stays inside the bone area and stays away from critical, you know, soft tissue like tendons and ligaments and blood vessels and nerves. So this is the type of work that you can do with a robot like this. We also have the surgeon controlling the robot with essentially a gas pedal. So the robot is doing an automated cut path, but the surgeon can control the speed and stop the robot with the gas pedal. So that's the robot side of it. So you can take the robot, you can create any kind of shape in the bone, like a negative image of an implant. But then you need a way to create the positive image or the implant itself that's going to go into that cavity. And that was really difficult to do. It was expensive and time consuming to do before the advent of 3D printing. But with 3D printing, we can now directly print in medical grade titanium in a device that's about the size of a refrigerator in a very economical way. And we can actually print 30 individual implants for 30 different people in a 12-hour period to deliver custom just-in-time inventory to whatever hospital they need to go. And in case you've never seen a 3D printer, this is how they work. It's basically a container that has a powdered substrate, in our case, very finely powdered titanium alloy, and a fine laser beam that sinters the beads of powder together and can create very intricate shapes and actually can create microstructures that mimic the lattice structure of bone, which turns out to be really important when you're designing implants that you want the patient's bone to grow into. So we can create porous metal structures that are really bone friendly, that bone likes to grow into. And ultimately, that's the name of the game, because we're trying to get away from cement with these implants. Like I showed you with that knee before, you know, cement fails. Cement is like, you know, you pour a cement sidewalk and it looks great for the first year. You come back 10 years later and it's got cracks and grass growing through it. So, you know, we want to have implants that are going to be what we call press fit or implanted without cement and designed for biological fixation so that the bone will actually grow into the implant. So with these tools at our disposal, we can get away from those kind of flat geometric implants that I showed you and really start to reimagine what's the best implant for a patient. Is it this kind of flat looking thing, or is it a more organic custom implant that's really designed to engage the best, most supportive bone and to resist motion of the implant when you put it in? So the platform starts with a CT scan. We run it through our AI software, creates the bone model, and then it creates the corresponding implant to go into the patient's bone. And it gives the robot instructions for what type of cavity it needs to mill into the bone. And we end up with a really highly conforming, high contact implant fit. And this is kind of our marketing video with the fake smoke, just to give you kind of a little sexier view of the robot. And, you know, it all makes sense, right? We talk to people all the time and they say, well, this makes inherent sense that you everything's custom. It's just going to work better. But, you know, nothing screws up a good idea like data. So we were very happy when we tested our knee implant and our hip implant at University of Nebraska and UCLA respectively. And what we found was that in fact it worked really better than we had thought it would. Our knee implant outperformed the leading uncemented knee implant made by Stryker by almost 300%. In other words, it was 300% more stable when we put it in. And our hip implant was 630% more stable than a leading commercially available hip implant. So, you know, and again, the importance of this is the more stability that we get with the implants, the better the bone is going to grow into it. If you put an implant in and it's got a little bit of micro motion, the bone just won't grow into it and they just get loose. So, we think that this is really going to be the next generation of orthopedic implants. And ultimately, we just feel like we can do better than the way we're doing it right now. So that's our technology. I'll just really briefly touch on kind of the story of the company and how we got going. So I had this idea in 2016, there was literally on a piece of scrap paper, and I went to the some people at Mount Sinai and presented the idea, and they really liked it. I got a lot of support from the medical school, and ended up getting an NIH grant, intramural grant through Sinai. Bought my first robot in 2016. I hired a robotics engineer off of LinkedIn, and we kind of got off the ground slowly. We just built a prototype. We got some early funding from a strategic investor, and that kind of got us to the next level where we could hire a couple more engineers. And then we were at the point where we really needed a team. We needed to have something real. You know, we just had kind of a very rough prototype at this point. So we went out to the traditional institutional capital sources, angels and VCs and whatnot, and really found the market to be very tough for a device company that was pre-FDA approval and pre-revenue. So what we ended up doing, because we really needed to start hiring an engineering team, was we did a crowdfund. And I've talked to Sunit a little bit about this, but we ended up doing a crowdfund, which is a relatively new thing. There was something in the Jobs Act under Obama that allowed kind of non-accredited investors to invest in privately held companies. So it's really changed the game for small startups. And we were able to raise about $15 million from the crowd. It took a lot of work. You know, we had to market it pretty heavily, but we actually closed our Series A crowdfund in the height of the lockdown in New York on April 24th. And we thought we'd be dead meat because, you know, everybody's locked down. Who's going to, you know, the economy's in tatters. Who's going to invest in a crazy robotic or orthopedic company? But it turned out that everybody was locked at home in front of their laptops looking for something to do, no sports to watch. So we ended up closing the deal really strong in the last couple months of the raise in March and April, and just started our Series B raise a couple weeks ago on a different crowdfunding platform. And we now have an office in Austin, Texas. We have 20 employees. We have a cadaver lab. We own 15 robots. And we're really kind of off to the races. And at this point, hope to commercialize the robot in 2023. We'll have an implant ready in 2022. And we should have some early revenue with a more off-the-shelf implant in the next quarter. So we should be seeing some revenue very soon, which we think will put us in a kind of a different category for raising money. Because again, there's kind of pre-revenue and post-revenue. And so our hope is that when we can show that we have some revenue, we will become more attractive to the VCs and even the strategics as a possible acquisition. So that's our story, and appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Doug. That was absolutely incredible. You know, very, very inspiring. So really appreciate it.
Thanks, Nate.
Thanks for joining. You know, that was amazing.